Welcome back. You're listening to Ad Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM and 100.5 FM. That's Elvis Costello. I write the book. I am very pleased to welcome our guest this week, who not only has written the book, she's written a number of books, and also is a nationally, and I will dare say globally, acclaimed writer in the form of being a columnist who I have followed her work for many, many years. Please join me in welcoming Ellen Goodman.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. I feel like I've been stalking you for a year to get you on the show.
Reading is different from stalking.
I know. I wasn't stalking. I was sending emails and saying that I grew up as a fan, and you know, our listeners know, but I grew up outside of Boston in a little town called Needham, and for some reason, when I was 17, the Needham Times let me write a little column, and that their good judgment prevailed after about a year. And they said something about not knowing anything about colon or semicolon or grammar and, you know, strunk and white and all that. So I've tried to be a writer, but really, you know, my day job is in the area of marketing. But I have such appreciation for people such as yourself that are so skilled in not only the technical part of writing, but more important, kind of the empathetic connection between important issues, important observations, and readers. And I think now it's even more important as we live in a digital world where thoughts and tweets and gibberish fly around. Thoughtful writing is so important, so it's great having you here today.
Thank you. I got to say, punctuation is not my strong suit either. So there you go.
So we've both tormented editors.
God invented editors. Right?
I know. I want to talk to you about specifically about editors, because sometimes I would send something in, and writing has kind of a rhythm, or at least, you know, what I've tried to do. And editors, sometimes they make it better. Many times, and professional editors really add, you know, the structure or little tweaks. But every once in a while, it was like, you know, what have they done to my song? It's like it goes in one way, and it feels like it comes out another.
Sure. Well, during all the years when I was syndicated, my column would go out to about 400 newspapers, and editors there might cut out, you know, the bottom. You know, you go through a column, you build an argument, you say, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, and then they cut out your conclusion. I mean, all kinds of things happen.
Or they take out the other hand and it looks like it's one side. Before we get to your right, if you wouldn't mind, let's talk about your background. You know, where you grew up, went to school, and then how that led to your interest in writing or studying English. And then I'd love to talk to you about your career and what you're doing now.
Well, I grew up right outside of Boston, also in Brookline, Massachusetts, went to schools there. And I went to Radcliffe College, which virtually doesn't exist anymore. It's now, it was at that time the co-ed with Harvard, but at this moment it's basically been merged. And it,
well, what happened? Because Radcliffe as a name is almost this iconic brand.
It is. But, and there's still the Radcliffe Institute, which is terrific, and they're doing great work. But the undergraduate life, which when I was I applied to Radcliffe, and I actually graduated in the first class that got joint diplomas of Harvard and Radcliffe. So I was kind of on the cusp of change, and I think that's true for my generation. We kept being on the cusp of every change, you know, barely.
So
and
Radcliffe,
now we're talking just as we're on the cusp of Hillary Clinton being the
unbelievable
first woman nominee. So that our generation has been, of women, has been on the cusp of change all the way through.
So Radcliffe has been it absorbed academically relative to Harvard?
We went to co-ed classes. Radcliffe and Harvard were co-ed since World War II. But we had, of course, separate dorms in those days. There were not co-ed dorms. And we got a separate diploma from Radcliffe College. And then in the mid-70s, it merged together. So you apply to Harvard, you graduate from Harvard, you take classes there.
Was there much competitive spirit relative to Wellesley College, and, you know, which is the alma mater of our Democratic nominee Hillary Rodham Clinton? But was there the juxtaposition of Radcliffe and Wellesley during that time, or just
separate? I think it was slightly different people went to it. It's interesting in the work I'm doing now. I'm working with three women who graduated from Wesleyan in actually three generations. And my impression is that the women who went to Wellesley, which was an all-women's college,
right.
Had a they went and worked in the world. And the women who went to Radcliffe in my generation, with a few of us who exceptions, they went into academia, and then they went into professional work. But in my generation, a lot of them, when I went to my 50th
wow.
college reunion, most of the women in my class had been academics or something. There were a few of us who were journalists, which I regard as working in the world in a different way. But at Wellesley, I think they were more encouraged to, I can't even think of what their slogan is, but it's much more doing in the world. And I think that was certainly true for Hillary's class, which was...
I should know the slogan because I will confess something now to our audience in Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. Growing up in Needham, which is an adjacent town, I remember being 16 or 17 years old, growing up right next to Wellesley College, which is a beautiful campus and a great academic institution. And a couple of my buddies and I, on a Friday night, there would be like dances over at Wellesley College. We would jump into my friend John Rudberg's car, 72 Ford Maverick. We'd turn on the AM radio, and we would go, let's drive through Wellesley College. I think some of the co-eds may really find us interesting and attractive.
Interesting. 16-year-old.
It never happened. It never happened. All that happened was we would end up later on in the night going, oh, that was fun. We went to Howard Johnson's and had like blueberry toasties in Wellesley Center. So that was my experience at Wellesley College.
Well, and of course, you know, Radcliffe and Harvard were co-ed. And if you were a student at Harvard and you dated somebody at Wellesley, it was a long
right.
and a very historical ride back because they had parietal hours.
Right.
Now, parietal hours, your listeners don't even know what those are, but you had to get in the dorm at a certain hour.
Either you have dorm mothers or sign people in, and it was a very kind of rigid approach in terms of the social stratosphere.
Right.
We have Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Ellen Goodman here today. So talk about after Radcliffe. What was it? Was your academic experience, was it the base for you wanting to pursue a career in writing? Or what was the first catalyst as you're graduating that brought you into the writing?
Well, I never took a course in journalism.
Wow.
I never wrote for my college newspaper. I never wrote for my high school newspaper. I did not deliver newspapers in my neighborhood when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
So, and that's not so unusual for my generation of women. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was a history major, did not take English classes even. I was very comfortable writing, always. And when I was graduating, there were really very few jobs open to women. A couple of jobs that I had interviews for, the one that was most appealing was as a researcher for Newsweek magazine. And in those days, they hired overeducated young women for truly crummy jobs.
So just doing background research and going...
Yeah.
Back then, there was no computers, right? So it was microfiche, and research was kind of this manual,
and wires,
arduous process.
The news used to come over what we called wires in a kind of... It looks sort of like mimeographs, and you rip them off and deliver them to... the writers.
When people would say hot off the wire, it was literally, it would be
literally
a wire,
Literally. That's where I saw the announcement of Jack Kennedy's death when I was working on the wire, ripping it off. But at those days, if you were a woman, you could not write. It was sex discrimination was legal. People remember that it happened, but they forget that it was actually legal. So women were researchers and men were writers. And the one of the first people I worked for there was Peter Benchley, who I'd gone to college with. Do you remember? He was the author of Jaws.
Famous author, very accomplished.
Really nice guy, and I had known him pretty well in college. And he was literally a writer, and I was literally the researcher.
That is fascinating. So after Newsweek, I show in my notes that, is that when you pursued writing yourself and going to work with the Detroit Free Press?
Well, I started doing freelancing while I was at Newsweek because there was no opportunity to write for it. And then I got a job at the Detroit Free Press and was out in Michigan for 2 years.
Interesting. You and I spoke briefly before going on the air. In the mid-'80s, early-'80s, I was hired by Coca-Cola, and I was, I almost said stationed in Michigan. Michigan's lovely. There's, you know, for people in Michigan, they hold up a hand, and because the shape of the state is similar to that of a hand, you know, they go, well, where are you in the hand? Well, on the up part of the hand, it's beautiful and very rural. Detroit, as because of the industrial decay and many other reasons, can be a tough area, and there's certainly some economic challenges there. But while I was there, I wrote and submitted a couple of columns for the Detroit. No, it was a special op-ed, I think. I was invited at one point to be the judge of the Miss Michigan contest because I was the Coca-Cola marketing person, and it was a horrible experience. And I wrote about how uncomfortable it was. You know, Madonna's brother was a judge, some weather guy who was like a Ted Baxter kind of guy. And I wrote, and that was one of the areas which really got me interested in writing was, you know, having a forum to kind of write about experiences.
Yeah.
But for 2 years, what was it that brought you back? Because you really had no connection to Michigan or Detroit other than the opportunity to write for the paper, right?
Well, the Detroit Free Press was a great, lively, aggressive newspaper. And of course, I didn't know what I was doing, having never... I got hired basically without having written a news story and thrown in the first day. Wow. I went out and covered something, came back, wrote it up, and it was in the paper the next day. And I said, well, I guess I can do this, and started doing it virtually every day, which is great training. I think one thing that the notion of the deadline in journalism, the fact that, you know, you can be good, you can be bad, you just can't be late.
Right.
Is really critical for young people writing, because you don't have time for writer's block, or if you do, you're looking for work the next week. And also, you get sent out to cover and talk to people who you might never have talked to in your daily life, and to go to parts of the city and to cover things that might be pretty rough going, and to then share that experience with your readers.
Interesting. And what ultimately brought you back to Boston that led to you starting to write for the Boston Globe?
Well, I always preferred, I wanted to come home.
Right.
And the Boston Globe was also at that time just really coming into its own. And I was hired by Tom Winship, the great editor of the Boston Globe, to come. Of course, at that time, I was also pregnant, and I figured I better get a job. Nobody knew I was pregnant. You know, that still sort of goes on, but in those days,
the stigma.
We're talking about the late 60s. We're talking about there was no maternity leave. You got fired from jobs when you, quote, showed, end quote. And I was tall and thin and wore full dresses for quite a while, but I did stay on that job, and I like to say that I had my daughter and stayed at home in order to get her off to a good start in life, so I didn't go back to work till she was 6 weeks old, you know. But that was pretty unusual back then.
So did you start as a writer, and at what point did you go from writing for the Globe to some conversation taking place where some editor said, geez, Ellen, we either have a slot open, or we love your voice and your perspective and the opportunity to write a column, which is a different type of writing, and there's a different voice and tone, which I think is very distinctive to yourself. So how did that happen that you became a columnist?
Well, I was a news writer and a news feature writer, and then they opened up the op-ed page to in-house columns. And I think the first year I wrote maybe six of them over the course of the year, just about things I really cared about. It was very much in the same time as the onset of the women's movement. And there were virtually no, there were very few women
female
writing
voices,
on
right.
op-ed pages anywhere. And the subjects that I was writing about were not on op-ed pages. So that at those times, it was quite a separation between men were writing about politics, foreign affairs, et cetera.
Business.
Women were writing about, you know, family, home.
Cooking, home.
Yeah. And then the women's movement came along and said, guess what? The personal is political. So that what is personal, say, whether it's child care or whether it's family or whether it's relationships, or certainly at that time, whether it was about reproductive rights, those things are personal and political. And the wall between the personal and the political that existed in the newspaper as well as in everybody's life was coming down. And I very much wrote across those walls. And after that, I got a column. After that first year, I got a column for once a week. And then in the early 70s, I had a Nieman Fellowship, which is a fellowship for mid-career journalists, and came back and started doing it full-time and then was asked by the Washington Post to syndicate the column.
Fantastic. We have Ellen Goodman here. She is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and also author of a number of books, which we'll talk about. For you, which I think is fascinating, and I think it probably informs the skill you had and the unique and great voice you had as you continue to write, that you didn't go into it from a perspective of being a writer or a journalist when you graduated college. It looks like you were basically engaged in life, in perspective and insight. And for me, before you're able to write an export of you, you have to kind of either be open to living experiences, seeing, feeling, connecting with other people. But who are some of the writers that at that phase in your career, and as you mentioned, there weren't that many established women writers. There weren't that many women in media because it was a completely different time. But what writers, either male or female, did you read in the early part of your career that were so distinctive that you thought, yeah, that's an interesting voice. I don't want to copy it, but that's a standard that I think is reasonable to approach.
Well, in the late 60s and early 70s, there was the emergence of what was then called new journalism, where a much more personal voice was given permission. Prior to the Tom Wolfes and the
Hunter
Nora Ephrons and the
Hunter
Thompson's a little further,
but it was
further
personal.
Than I went.
But he lived in the story.
Yeah.
Which...
So there was that permission was granted to a certain extent at good places for a personal voice. That permission was very much a part of my emergence or my life as a columnist.
Right.
That. Yeah, I'm writing not just as a political observer, but as a participant.
Right.
And that might not have really flown some years before. I remember once interviewing Irma Bombeck, who I loved and who
right.
was an absolute delight. And in some ways, she became quite a feminist, but she was often regarded earlier as the kind of household homemaker columnist,
right.
you know, writing about the socks getting eaten in the washer and dryer. And yet it was clear that she had very strong views on life. And just the difference between when her generation and mine, or, you know, these time frames were relatively short because change happened so fast
right.
in that period that you went kind of from Irma Bombeck to, you know, a lot of other women's voices that were crossing that line between the personal and the political.
And it was interesting to me because I think in relative to the format of columnist writing, I think one of the early genres which really kind of set the stage were sports, because typically, you know, I grew up reading the sports pages, and there is a distinction which sometimes today people lose on the internet for columnist versus news versus opinion versus op-ed, and each one has its own important place. But it started out as people had sports views. So there'd be, you know, the Globe probably had a half a dozen sports writers and columnists, and they would write, you know, there would be news stories on what the Celtics did, the Red Sox did, or the Bruins did. But then somebody would write, we should trade so-and-so, and the Red Sox aren't doing well, and they're not. You know, I think that was also the era where general columnists about life, its own self, became a platform, whether it's for women's issues or whether it's for, you know, to me, I love reading about interesting topics, whether they fit the silo of sports or business or politics. And your writing, you know, is somebody who's followed your career and your columns for many, many years. You would always approach a subject or whatever the subject was of the column, but really have not only a strong voice, but your own perspective, which was grounded in kind of the practical, the reasonable, and a point of view you wouldn't see all the time.
Well, there you go. I conned you into thinking I was
you
reasonable.
You didn't con anyone. Nobody cons anyone into. But it was always interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting thinking about what's happened to commentary now, because I always said, what do you do for a living? I tell people what I think.
Right.
You know, and the first part of that is the thinking. First, you have to think.
Right.
And now so much happens so fast that a lot of opinion has devolved into food fight.
Impulse. And
You're just throwing opinions at each other. And it's not, you don't even have time, let alone the chit to spend time thinking about what it is. I mean, imagine 144. What can you say in 144 characters?
Very little.
You can't say anything. You can't be thoughtful.
Well, I think
column writing is hard enough, because I've often described column writing as you take everything out of your closet and put it in your overhead suitcase. You know, you still are. You're distilling stuff down a lot, but you can't put it in a tweet.
I know.
It doesn't happen.
I know. You just reminded me, in the next 24 hours, I have a deadline. And now I'm starting to get nervous, because you mentioned earlier that the format of writing in terms of the deadline, it's a unique thing, the deadline. That parameter, especially when you put it against what people try to approach, and I try to approach with like kind of creative thought, where you have 3 hours to go, 2 hours to go. You get a note from the editor, is the column done yet? I need it by noon, because we've got to set the page. And there are times where great things come out of that tetronic pressure, and there are times where sometimes I will reference lyrics to a song to eat up 100 words and go, Bruce Springsteen made my point exactly right when he wrote Born to Run. I'll attribute it, so it's not a plagiarism, but it'll be like, how do I get another 100 words? And the famous saying, if I had more time, I could have made it shorter, applies to the distilling or the distillation process of writing a column and being concise.
Well, you're talking about two separate things, one of which is the pressure of the deadline, which is real, and sometimes you don't want to read them, you know.
Right.
But you're also thinking a little bit about how that over time becomes a lot. And about 6 years ago, I left the column because it was, you know, it was enough. I felt complete about that. And I moved from writing about observing social change to trying to make it, because I co-founded The Conversation Project, which is a public engagement campaign to have people's wishes for end-of-life care expressed and respected. And that's been a fascinating encore career, if you will, a second stage to try to see all those things that I had seen about how change happens, to try and be more deliberate and think about the next great social change that I've been involved with.
Well, let's talk about that. We have Ellen Goodman here in the studio. Ellen is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist who has featured as a marquee columnist with both the Boston Globe and then syndicated around the country to about 400 newspapers, and also author of many books. Talk about the project, the Conversation Project, because I've read some of your pieces and I agree with your perspective. I think the continuum of life, you know, includes death, and I think we as a society don't talk about it, don't address it, don't plan for it, and don't engage in kind of a healthy acceptance. And as the baby boom generation is aging, there's a huge wave of people, and particularly here in Maine, where we have the oldest population. So the idea of mortality and death and dignity is really important. So go into a little bit of detail about the Conversation Project, and I've got a couple of your pieces here, and talk about where you think we should take, I don't know if it's a more compassionate approach or a more realistic approach to the process of aging and the rights and the dignity of people going, approaching their mortality.
Well, one thing I've discovered since starting the Conversation Project, and I started in the aftermath of my experience with my mother's death, but one thing I've discovered is that everybody has a story, and it's a story of a good death or a hard death. But everybody has had an experience. And often the difference between whether it was a good or a hard death is whether they knew what the wishes were for their loved one's end-of-life caring,
right,
how she wanted to live at the end of her life, the care he wanted, the care he didn't wanted. Whether your whole family was on the program, whether the doctor and the patient were on the same program.
Legal issues in terms of resuscitating and all that.
We started by saying people really need to talk about this. Too many people are dying in the way that they do not choose, and too many families are left depressed and anxious about what happened. So we said, first thing we need to do is get everybody to the kitchen table to talk with the people they love about how they want to live at the end of their life. And we have on our website, I hope your listeners will go to it, theconversationproject.org, we have a conversation starter kit that isn't scary and isn't medical,
right,
and really helps people to start these conversations with their family or friends, for that matter. So that was really the way that we started. And just as a reminder, we started the Conversation Project when the atmosphere was all filled with words like death panel. You know, the fact that your doctor might even talk to you, might be paid for his or her time talking to you about what your wishes were translated by Sarah Palin and others into death panels. The government is a death panel. And everybody in Washington kind of dove under their desk about this. But people knew, real people who have had experiences knew the importance of these conversations. And we've come all the way through. I think we've really reached a pretty big tipping point where doctors are now paid for having these conversations with you. But our first goal is really that you would have it with your family. I'm about to ask you if you had.
Right.
But you would have it with your family, and then you would choose a decision maker, someone who can speak for you if you can't speak for yourself,
right,
and a huge number of people can't at the end of their life. And so that when the time came, you would as much as possible end your life, have the life you lead your life at the very end in the way that you would choose. So have you had the conversation?
I have, Ellen Goodman. My wife and I have, I wouldn't say recently, in the last few years, we're active in estate planning, active in terms of talking to our kids, in terms of plans, and, you know, whether it's technical issues of, you know, the wish of being cremated or buried, or, you know, whether it's the estate planning or the financial. But, you know, I want to talk to you about kind of the legislative environment. You wrote a column recently, I think in June, for the Washington Post, and the headline was "The Comfort of a Humane, Caring End of Life." And you talk about California legislation being the fifth and largest state to make physician-assisted death legal. And then you also talk about Oregon. There's also the mental capacity issue of at what point do you believe, I think everyone should have their control of their wishes. But I think one of the challenges for both families and in the medical community is when a person no longer may have the mental acuity to make those choices responsibly, and how do you measure and weigh that, the interest of the person versus their capacity? So I think the idea is to have the conversation early, so it's a clear, thoughtful, understood wish, and not wait to the point where the person can't kind of express their wishes.
Well, the first thing we found in a poll that we did is that 90% of people think it's important to have these conversations. That's huge. 90% of people don't agree on anything, including the national anthem.
Right.
But only 30% have had it. So our central goal is to close that gap and to say the most important thing to do is to have this conversation. In thinking about death with dignity, doctor-assisted suicide, whatever the language is, and everybody seems to have a different way to describe it, the big thing to remember is that in Oregon, where doctor-assisted suicide has been legal for 10 years, only one out of every 500 people chooses it.
So it's a relatively small number, but it gets a lot of press. It gets a lot of attention.
It's hugely controversial. And it doesn't help.
Right.
I have said that I'm in favor of it, but I've said, let's not kid ourselves. This is not what we need. This is not what's going to reduce suffering and change the way we have it. What's going to change it is talking about it and having our wishes expressed and respected. So why are we going into this hugely controversial food fight over this one out of every 500, let's do something that's going to help the 499.
And that is the conversationproject.org for anyone listening. So when people go
You mentioned, Steve, I wanted to add another thing. You mentioned the issue of whether you are competent to make decisions for yourself. And we have a new tool on our website for families of people with dementia and Alzheimer's.
Interesting.
Because that is such a...
Is it a measurement tool or is
No, it's a tool to help people have the conversation, their families, to help bring that person into the room and what their wishes actually were.
And that's at www.theconversationproject.org.
Mm-hmm.
That is... So if people go to that website, and Maine has an older population, our audience in LOB and people listening to talk radio tend to be older... What will they find relative to information or the tool?
Well, they'll find stories and they'll find tools. We have stories of many people and their stories of end of life, but we also have tools. And so we have a tool which is the Central Conversation Starter Kit, which, as I said, is not medical. It's not scary, but it is about what matters to you. It's about values and what matters to you, and to help you think together with the people you love about what's important to you, whether you want to die at home or in a hospital, whether you're what is it that makes life worth living to you. Then we have a kit for families of children with serious illness. We also have one for dementia and Alzheimer's, as I said. And we're doing a kit this summer, not a kit, but a small piece of paper on how to choose a healthcare decision maker. Because it's how to choose and how to be one, because it's critical. I don't know how many of your listeners know the word proxy, healthcare proxy, which,
right.
But it's somebody who can make decisions for you if you can't make them for yourself. And just to put it into a realistic context, half of all the people over 65 who go into a hospital cannot make decisions for themselves, are not capable at that moment to make decisions for themselves. So if you want what is important to you, what is important to your parents, to be at the heart of what happens, you better have these conversations early. We have a slogan at the Conversation Project. It's always too soon until it's too late.
That's fantastic. Well, I think it's a great project, and there's a lot of information you've written about that's there. And that's theconversationproject.org. We have Ellen Goodman, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and famed book author. And I am unofficially the president of your fan club, so I appreciate you being here. And in the few minutes we have left, I'd love to get your perspective on the current political climate. You were not known as a political columnist, but you talked about life its own self, and politics certainly intersects every area of our kind of organized society. Is this the craziest period you've seen relative to the discourse, relative to engagement by the public, relative to what's been accepted as kind of day-to-day?
Well, certainly the craziest
presidential campaign.
It's the craziest competition I've ever seen. You right. have a woman who, as President Obama said, is the most qualified person
regardless
who's ever
of gender, yep.
been running for president or ever been ready for this job. And then you have Donald Trump, who is a reality show host and clearly doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
So it's really it's extraordinary to me when I listen to him spouting off stuff that anybody would vote for him. And I've now just alienated the 41% of people who are going to vote for him. But it's just incredible. The man doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a little bit of political experience the last decade. I was chairman of a local town council, and I ran unsuccessfully for U.S. Senate. And I'm proud to say that our current U.S. Senator, Angus King, who I ultimately supported, I think is doing a great job. But my observation from both serving in elected office and running is that much of the electorate have become disassociated from the idea of government service being connected to competency. And the analogy I've used and I've written about is when we get on an airplane, we look into the cockpit and there's a pilot there, and his or her competency is measured by the FAA. They've gone through training. They're skilled. If I fall off my chair here and, you know, my FEMA is sticking out of my leg, and I'm like, Ellen, Sully, please call. You know, well, we need a competent transportation system, so we use an ambulance. Then we need, you know, a competent surgeon. And I really like a competent anesthesiologist. So we recognize in certain areas of life skill, accreditation, and accepted, you know, talent with what's required of a job. But when it comes to most, and clearly now in the presidential realm, because the highest office in the land this applies to, much of the public, they don't see competency in the role of government, whether it's on town council, whether it's in state legislatures, Congress. It's become either popularity or an impulse issue, or I like him, he speaks for me. But the job of serving the people is very critically important, and there's so many skill elements of understanding finance, law, energy, healthcare issues, and education. But I share your view on Donald Trump. He's just not competent in any of these areas.
So there has also been a concerted campaign to say that government is incompetent, and therefore we need to get rid of government. So let's not discount. Of course, there's incompetence in government. You know, where isn't there incompetence? But
government's not a thing. It's a collection of people, right? So it's the people ultimately.
So, you know, there has been a concerted campaign, however, to say that anybody in government is already incompetent. And, you know, I don't believe that. There are, as I said, people who are incompetent, but that isn't it. But it's pretty disheartening. And I'm just going with the hope that it actually has a cumulative effect in which people say, finally, this guy is totally incompetent.
Well, I hope so, too, because November is 100 days.
We have gone to food fight journalism. We have gone to not even journalism. We have gone to this division where we aren't listening to each other.
Right.
But we are hurling opinions rather than, you know, sharing them.
but let's talk about journalism, because I grew up in an era, and I think in your part of your career, there were kind of benchmarks, a delineation between journalism and the National Enquirer and gossip and before the internet, where on Sunday night watching 60 Minutes, if Mike Wallace or somebody said, we're going to talk about Central America, there was faith in what was being conveyed. If I read the Boston Globe and there was an investigative report, there was a sense of this is real, this, you know, and so I will base my opinion, my thinking, predicated on some real standards. From your experience as working in the one of the highest levels of journalism, how much of what's going on now, without just blanketly blaming the media, is born from, you know, the decay of the economic foundation of journalism, where no longer can newspapers and print journalism sustain itself, so it has to be tied into the internet? And when things are digitized, you lose a sense of what's real because it all comes across as bits and bytes. You know, if you pick up the New York Times or the Boston Globe, it's real, it's tactile, it's written by a reputable journalist like yourself or someone else. But when stuff flows across the internet, you hear Trump say that all the time, well, I read it somewhere, or this was here. Information loses, you know, currency of what is real and what isn't. And I feel like that's adding to the decay of both political involvement and investment. And it allows people the freedom to go, well, I think this because of this, without accountability.
Well, you know, I share your dismay at what is happening, but I'm not sure that it is new. You know, what was that famous line? Lies fly across the world. Truth. What? Truth. Well, truth is still putting on it, lacing up its shoes or something. That's not entirely new. I do think that people, the internet allows, and cable television and all these things allow people to choose to go only to their own silo, to listen in a closed loop only to people that agree with them, and to find like a cohort group of people who are constantly agreeing with them.
Our research staff, by the way, pulled up your quote, and it's a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes.
Well, it was close enough.
Well, there were shoes involved.
But you see, you missed in my world, I would have fact-checked that before I wrote it.
I know. We can thank Emily.
Fact-checking is such an interesting thing because this is very much of what you were talking about. Do facts matter?
Facts matter. I think they're critically important.
And do people, I mean, as a young journalist, for sure, we used to stay up at night and say, oh, God, was that 10,336? Or was it 10,340? And, you know, you'd have an anxiety attack about whether you'd made a mistake.
And you'd have to transcribe notes.
It's gone.
I know. And sometimes you'd record interviews, but sometimes you'd write things down. And
but there are also a lot of really good young journalists at these web pages. I've been on the Livingston Awards for Young Journalists for many, many years. And we have all kinds of new digital journalism sites with young journalists doing great investigative work. And at the same time, let's not forget Spotlight, the Oscar award-winning movie.
Wow.
Which came out of the Globe in a...
Their special department dedicated to in-depth investigative reporting, right?
But that respect for that kind of work and the impact that the investigation of the church scandal has had a huge international effect. So don't despair too much.
But I'm despairing.
No, I said don't despair.
I know. Ellen Goodman just told me not to despair. But when something like climate change, which ultimately is rooted in science, and I've spent some time in the last few years having guests on the show that were climatologists, that were, you know, UMaine has a group, I think 71 or 72 people in a climate cross-discipline department where there's geology, astrophysicists, ocean study. And virtually everyone in science looks at the isotopes in the Antarctic. I went to Iceland last year and walked on the glaciers and saw firsthand what was happening. And you would think, to any reasonable, educated, open-mind, critical thinking.
Well, now you're reminding me of Stevenson's favorite line when the woman came up to him and said, to Adlai Stevenson, ran for president in 56 and 52.
Right.
And a woman came up to him and said, Governor Stevenson, every thinking person in America is going to vote for you. And he said, that's too bad. I need a majority. So
I know,
there is.
But we live in the information age. You know, back in that
era. Well, we live in the information age, Steve, with also a huge number of people who still believe the world was created in 7 days. So it's a constant struggle.
But we're talking about 40 or 50% of the population. We're not talking about fringe. If it's like woe is us or woe is the republic, if we waste so much time on what I think are core issues, which are, whether or not it's happening at one rate or another.
Well, you got to figure out ways to bring them to you. And you have to do that with seriousness and with some respect. In writing, it was always important to me, even when I wrote about stuff that was very controversial and that I felt very strongly about, it's important to tip your hat to people who disagree with you because you're trying to convince them, not to bat them over the head by saying they're stupid.
Right.
Now, I happen to think that anybody who doesn't believe in global warming has got a screw loose. But you got to reach people where they are and bring them to where you are. And some things just take longer than others. And some things don't happen until there's a real crisis.
I am hoping some of your optimism rubs off. I am open to it.
I'm not that optimistic. You're just pushing my optimism button.
I
could have done the pessimistic side of this discussion, too.
We could go the other side of it. We have Ellen Goodman here. She has a website, ellengoodman.com. She's started the Conversation Project. She's involved with the Conversation Project, which is certainly an important discussion, and there's some resources there talking about end-of-life planning, awareness, and as Ellen has said, you know, one of the first steps is talking about it, having a conversation and kind of taking it out of the shadows, and as family members and as loved ones share in the continuum of life, bringing other thinking and awareness to that. But what's the future for you? You're not writing the active column, but you're writing articles or you're working on a new book. I don't want to disclose any personal information, but my understanding is you live in Boston, but you come up to Maine quite often and you enjoy Maine.
Oh, yeah.
What was it or is it about Maine that made it an interesting location for you, at least vacation or spend part of your summer in?
Well, my husband brought me up to Maine originally, and we have a summer home here, or a spring, summer, fall, whatever,
yeah.
home here. And it's the place that I sit with my feet up on the porch and think and often write and just enjoy life. And I have great involvement in the Conversation Project. I do some personal writing. I've also been very active in something called Encore.org, which is Second Acts for the Greater Good, which is a group dedicated to having people's second acts when they're over 50 or 60, thinking not so much about retirement, but about giving back. So there are many pieces of life, including being a grandparent and just enjoying it and not having deadlines that have opened up since I left the column.
Well, you know, final thought I had, which is kind of bounces around from our conversation over the last 40 minutes. We have Ellen Goodman here. I want to talk about America's older generation, which I am now a card-carrying AARP member, where it feels like, I don't know if it is specific to the U.S. or I think in other countries and other cultures, they look at older citizens differently. You know, you read and hear about Indian culture where tribal leaders are respected and revered. But it feels like we don't do a good enough job, either through family units reinforcing connections to grandparents and older neighbors, but we kind of discard the value and the insight and the wisdom and the of older Americans, older generation. And it sometimes breaks my heart because some of the most interesting, rewarding conversations I've ever had with anyone, and I've worked with business leaders and politicians and successful people, are people, I don't want to put an age group on it, but a retirement age in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And it doesn't feel like we celebrate and embrace those conversations and those people as much as we should. And I think it's a real loss for us in general as a society. But why is that?
I think it's important. We're in the midst of a longevity revolution. The average American lives 30 years longer than we did 100 years ago. And the Social Security, this was all geared to the average lifespan being 65, and it's 20 years beyond that now.
And medicine and technology is even extending it.
And there is a real need to reinvent what age means in this country and to engage older people and what they have learned and to encourage a sense of purpose in the later part of your life. I'm 75, so I'm very conscious of this age and the need to keep being involved. And one of the things that we need to do particularly is to reduce what is often seen as a generational conflict into a generational connection. So people often say of older people that either they're clogging the pipeline and you young people can't get jobs, or they're dependent on Social Security and they're, you know, using up all the social resources. So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Right.
And what actually we need to encourage these connections and this sense of purposeful work that older people are engaged in our society so that they aren't seen as kind of irrelevant, passive, unimportant parts. And part of that needs to come from older people ourselves, that we stay engaged and have meaningful activity. And some of it needs to come from the end of this kind of ageism that you were describing. Right. We've just been through a fascinating, in England, what was called the Brexit vote to leave the EU, the European Union. Older people voted 2/3 to leave the union. Younger people voted 2/3 to stay in. And older people, however, 2/3 of them voted, and younger people, only 1/3 of them voted. But there is this sense that came out of that was of a generational conflict.
Right.
And what we need to do is to change the narrative into the other reality of us all being connected, whether it's through family or through work. But it's all we need this incredible resource of this growing older generation to really be engaged in social work, social change work, work with children, et cetera.
Well, despite you self-revealing your age, I don't look at you as being old or young. I look at you as being dynamic. It has been a pleasure having you on. And as I've said, you know, through the many emails, and I've been sending Ellen emails down to her Boston email address for months, when you come up to Maine, and I'm so happy and so honored that you took the time out of your day to come by the studio, because it's been such a pleasure and honor having you here today.
Well, thank you, Steve. I enjoyed it a lot.
I welcome you to come back. If you're ever in the neighborhood, consider an open invitation. And I encourage people to buy one of Ellen's books that I think are still available on Amazon. If you just Google, there's some interesting topics, life topics that are fascinating. Also on Facebook, Facebook/ Ellen Goodman Columns. And then the project that is near and dear to her heart, the www.theconversationproject.org, talking about the issues related to and the opportunity for people to discuss and address and talk about the subject of death and the subject of making plans, going forward as an older person, right?
Thank you. Or as a young person.
Or as a young person. and we can all be young at heart. So thank you very much. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM. We will be back next week. Thank you.